Please turn in the Word of God to the Gospel of Luke as we continue our studies in the morning worship service in this Gospel. We come this morning to the 8th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, and we're going to be reading the verses 22 through 40, or 39 rather. Luke's Gospel, chapter 22. One day he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they set out, and as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. And they went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased. And there was a calm. He said to them, "Where is your faith?" And they were afraid. And they marveled, saying to one another, "Who then is this that he commands even winds and water, and they obey him?" Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. And when Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house but among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he could not or would not, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs were feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and were drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the country and in the city. Then people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom he had demons had gone out, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. And there we end over the reading of God's Word. Jesus has finished preaching his parables. Not all the parables, but the portion that he'd been preaching. And now he's setting out to cross the lake of Gennesaret to get to the other side. He's not going alone. He has the disciples with him. It is at his instruction that they leave. And they follow him obediently. He says, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they set out. Jesus is tired. And so he goes into the ship or the boat. A boat of probably 20 feet long by 8 feet wide. And he lies down and falls asleep. And there are then an event that occurs that manifests, demonstrates the irrationality of fear that so often comes over our lives as Christians. A fear that comes through a lack of truly believing what we profess to believe. I don't know how long this sermon is going to take this morning. It may be finished in 15 minutes, maybe one of the shortest sermons I've ever preached. We'll see. I had and was going to take the two sections, but I think I'm just going to take the one section. But I think the point that Christ brings to us in this section, verses 22 to 25, is of such importance to us. Because often in our lives, we do not walk in the ways of God because of an irrational fear. And by irrational, I mean a fear that is rational in the eyes of the world, or justifiable in the eyes of the world, but is irrational for those who profess to believe in a sovereign, all-knowing, all-powerful God. And so it goes to the very essence, the very heart of how we live as Christians, and the way in which we reach decisions that we reach, decisions which can have huge impact on not only our lives, but the lives of those that we love. This event is a natural occurrence. By that I mean, it happens in nature. This lake lies between high hills, and the hills form a valley. And it wasn't unusual for the wind to come down that valley, come down onto the lake, and to cause the lake to begin to turmoil, for the wind to get up and the wind to press against the shoreline and begin to whip the waves into a tumult. And this tumult that is raging was not just the ordinary windstorm. There was an element to this that engendered great, great fear in the disciples. These men were not unused to being on the water, nor were they not unused to being such circumstances as these. They were fishermen, some of them. Not all of them, but some of them. Accomplished fishermen, owning businesses. They would have experienced something to a degree of this previously. But here in the providence of God, God allows a storm to form that really scares these men deeply. And the men who have not been brought up on the water, the men who have not been fishermen, when they look at the men who are fishermen, they see this fear on their faces. And that generates within them a huge sense of uneasiness. They see in the fellow apostles who have fished these waters on many previous occasions a whiteness, a terror, that leaves them gasping, as it were, for their lives because of the fear that's been struck into them. The water is engulfing the boats that they are in. They're out in the middle of the lake. Mark, in his account, says that the waves are crashing into and filling the boat. Matthew says the boat was covered by waves. The waves were actually coming in and coming over one side of the boat and cascading and carrying over and over the other side of the boat. It wasn't just that the boat was being tossed about and bouncing up and down in the high waves. The waves were actually forming, as it were, a circle around the boat. They were engulfing it. And so if they looked out, all they saw was water. They didn't just see water in the plain around them. They saw water in the sky above them because the waves were crashing in among them. It would have been an open vessel. There wouldn't have been a place a place where they all have got into and carried the storm out. They cannot cope with the peril that is unfolding around them. And so they turn to Jesus. Jesus the carpenter, who is lying sleeping in the boat. They look to him in order to provide for them the safety that they need. Master, Master, we are perishing. It gives us a sense of the feeling of the sheer trauma, the nearness to death that these men feel that they're in. It's astonishing that they would turn to Jesus, as I say, given the fact that there was a number of them were expert sailors, and that he had worked with his hands in his carpenter's father's shop. But you see, they are at the end of their tether. They don't know what to do. All they can do is turn to Jesus. Why do I call that an irrational fear? Surely if any of us would have been in that situation, we too would have been awestruck by what was going on. We would have been riven with fear as well, given the trauma of the sea. You don't have to be in the sea and too much of a swell for it to engender fear. You don't have to be traveling on the sea and the vessel you're traveling in bouncing up too much and too down for you to begin to think, oh, this isn't nice. I don't like this. If we had been in that boat at the same time as those men, we would have been saying to them that their fear was completely understandable. Their fear was completely justifiable. It was completely rational. You could understand why these men were in this state of almost paralyzed, non-activity because of what was cascading all around them. So why call it irrational? Well, these men were with Jesus Christ. And these men had seen and heard Jesus engage in a number of activities, teaching and healing, that communicated to them that he, Jesus, was different. A man, yes, but he was distinctly different. The very fact that they go to him at the heightened moment of their fear speaks of the fact that they knew Jesus was different. The fact that they didn't say, well, there's nothing he can do. He has never been in this situation before. There's no experience that he can bring to bear on our present situation. What can he do that will help us? What will he be able to do that will save our lives? There was something in Jesus that they had seen, that they had heard, that had resonated with them, that manifest within their minds and their hearts a sense of, if we can get him awake, he will be able to deal with this situation. He will be able to address it. They didn't know how. They'd never been in this situation before and seen Jesus deal with it. But they had this faith, sufficient faith that they believed he could do something about it. And yet, their faith was such that they had to waken him up to get him to do something about it. Their faith was not sufficiently strong enough to grasp the fact that if he is here with us, then it will be all right. They needed to see Jesus do something. They needed Jesus to intervene somehow in this way. They did not know how, but they needed to see Jesus intervene in some way in order to deal with the tangible reality of what was going on. They couldn't, between them, speak to one another and say, nothing is going to come of us because he is here. Let him sleep. Nor could they say, well, whatever comes of us, God has decreed. God has decreed that this should come to us, and we will accept it. And I wonder in our lives, when we find ourselves in really difficult situations, situations like we spoke about, or we sang together from Psalm 88, where we feel as though the world is just collapsing in around us, and there is nowhere we can turn. There's nothing we can do. There's no one we can talk to. Even our friends, as the psalmist says, have deserted us. He speaks of the fact that his friends have cast him off. You have caused my companions to shun me. You have made me a horror to them. I am shut up, shut in, so that I cannot escape. My eyes grow dim through sorrow. Whenever that sense of whatever God is doing in our lives, and we're crying out to God, and we're saying to God, please, please, please do something about this. Please show that you are there. It shows that we have faith, doesn't it? It shows that we're turning to God in those moments of real trial and real difficulty. It shows that we're not running around seeking this and seeking the other. But what if God doesn't answer immediately? What if God doesn't come in, like he doesn't do in that 88th Psalm, and bring immediate relief? How do we respond? Is it sufficient for us that we know and believe in Jesus Christ? Is it sufficient for us that we believe in the sovereign purposes of God, not just theologically, but in our hearts, that we actually believe that God is in control of all things, that he who spoke and the world came into existence, and that he who continues to hold the world in his hand and sustain it, he who gives cause for the sun to rise each morning and the sun to set each day, and the rain to flow and the vegetation to grow and the harvest to be gleaned, do we truly believe that he loves us and that he will protect and guard us no matter what? Or do we descend into a irrational fear? We have faith. We believe that God is in control. But there's a fear grips us, which is irrational because it is a denial of what we say we believe about God. I believe that God will protect. I believe that God will guard. I believe that God will keep. I believe that God is the great, almighty, all-powerful being that he is. But, in this situation, I'm not sure. I need to see some evidence of his love. Waking up, Jesus. Master, Master, do you not know my life is in real trial? Master, Master, do you not know I am in real difficulty here? Master, Master, will you not come and demonstrate in my life by doing something that shows that at least you're listening and you're not asleep? And surely, is there not in that a declaration of how small our faith is? When Jesus awakes here, he does something that's truly remarkable. He rebukes the wind and the raging waves, and the natural order listens to what Jesus says, and it obeys. And there is absolute calm. Calm in an instant from a raging, engulfing sea inferno to a mill pond in a second. God allowed the tempest, and God in the person of his Son deals with the tempest. And then he asks them this question that lies at the root of what I've been seeking to bring out this passage. Where is your faith? Where is your faith? Is your faith based on me always responding to your wants and your needs? Is your faith based solely on what you see and what you hear in your own life or in the life of those around you? Is your faith bolstered? Is your faith made alive by the fact that there's a tangibleness to my response? Or is your faith such that you take the fact that I am present with you and I am who I am? I am who I am. And is your faith sufficient to believe in me and believe in my word, so that whatever happens, no matter how catastrophic it is, Your pleading will be tempered with a, if your will so permits. The godly man, Psalm 112, we are told, is not afraid of bad news. His heart is firm, trusting in the Lord. His heart is steady. He will not be afraid until he looks in triumph on his adversaries. The godly man is a man who deals with bad news well, because his trust is in the Lord. That is really important. That is really important. And why that is important is because if our lives as Christians and our faith as Christians is lived solely on the tangible doing of God in our lives, then we will struggle. We will struggle. Because there are times in our lives, like Psalm 88, where God does not jump in and calm the storm. Because he is allowing that storm to come upon our lives to teach us serious lessons about dwelling in him and trusting in him. And if, as he deals with us to draw us deeper into a relationship with himself, if he deals with us in such a way as to draw and deeper our relationship with him, and he's dealing with us and he's using harsh difficulties in our lives, and he's using tempests in order to test and to trial us and to mature us and disciple us and discipline us, and if we constantly go to him and say, show me that you're real. Show me in some tangible way. Lift this. Ease this burden. And God doesn't ease the burden, because the burden is there to teach us that we're to come to him and trust him. Then what will happen is that we'll take a step back. God, I've asked you, I've pleaded with you to release me from this difficulty. I've asked you to release me from this burden. And God's given us that burden in order to draw us to him. But because we are so looking to some tangible, concrete evidence of his healing or his dealings with us, whether financial or relational, whatever it is, we're looking for some token of God's blessing upon us. And he doesn't give it for good reason. Then we take a step back and say, God, where are you? Where are you? Where are you? When all the time we should be saying, God, you're there. You're there. You're there. Jesus was there. He hadn't left the boat. He had not got up under the boat and walked away. He was there. He was asleep, but he was there. And we should run to God. And we should say to God, God, I love you. This is hard. This is difficult. But I know you're there. I know you love me. We should run to worship. We should run to him in his word. We shouldn't doubt. We shouldn't question. It's irrational for the Christian who says they believe in God and trust in God and knows God. It's irrational for the Christian who says, I'm believing in the death of Jesus Christ to take me to heaven for all eternity. It's irrational for the Christian then to say, God, you'll not protect me until the day that you take me to that eternity. It's irrational for the Christian always needing to be fed tangible, concrete proofs of God's love. We love him because he has revealed himself in his word. We love him because the revelation of himself tells us that he is real. We love him because we have faith. And faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. It's the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Faith is not saying, I will believe because I have seen. Faith is saying, I hope because I believe. I have conviction because although I have not seen it, I know the one who has made the statement. And I believe in him. My confidence in him, my trust is in him. The disciples were afraid no longer of the sea. They marveled. Who then is this that he commands even winds and water and they obey him? Who is this? Who is this? Who is this? Is this the one you believe in? Is this the one you have trust in? Is this the God that you walk with? Are you still looking for a God who will come to you and give you what you want and so prove that he's real? No such God exists. No such God exists. But there is a true God who is worthy of our worship and our adoration, who is sovereign, who is ever present. And no matter what trial, tribulation we face, we run to him, being sure of what we hope for and of conviction about what we do not see, because our trust is in him as God. In him as God, and not in him and what he does for us. Amen.